everyone. Welcome to the Narcissism Dakota, a podcast that takes a comprehensive look at the various facets of narcissism from different psychoanalytic perspectives. I am your host, Dr. Anthony Mazzella. In today's episode, we will explore another narcissistic personality type, that which is commonly known as the paranoid narcissist. The goals of this episode are as follows. First, I like to describe the unique characteristics of this cluster or type of narcissism. Then I like to give an example so we can get a good look at how this presents. To think about the cause, in other words, what leads up to this particular cluster of narcissism, we need to delve a little bit into psychoanalytic theory. And then finally, what are the implications for treatment? Or how do I relate to someone like this? I think this is a lofty list of goals for one episode. We may need to break this up into two episodes, but let's see how much we can cover. The paranoid narcissistic individual exhibits all the hallmark traits of narcissism, including a grandiose sense of self, a pervasive need for admiration, a lack of empathy for others, and a need for excessive attention and admiration. Stated differently, they seek the magical reunion of the ideal self with the all-giving, omnipotent other. Remember that example I gave in a prior episode? The baby cries and the breast appears. And as always, I'm using the word breast symbolically. These individuals may exploit others for their own gain. They possess a sense of entitlement, and they have a very strong tendency to be envious of others' achievements or possessions. The paranoid narcissist, again, like all narcissists, has a fragile self-esteem that's easily wounded. However, contempt and devaluation, though utilized by all types of narcissists, require careful consideration if we aim to gain a deeper understanding of the paranoid narcissistic individual. All right, so you might be thinking, contempt and devaluation are big deals to watch out for. That's what I'm telling you, right? But what else sets this type of narcissism apart? In other words, what else sets the paranoid narcissist apart from the other clusters? And how can I tell if the narcissist in my life is the paranoid kind? Laid upon these classical narcissistic characteristics, there are distinct and pronounced signs of paranoia. These individuals are not overtly psychotic. Actually, some can live quite productive lives. For instance, if they work in security as a security consultant, or if you're going through a contentious divorce, you may want a paranoid attorney on your side. The signs and symptoms of this cluster of narcissism manifest as an excessive or irrational distrust of others. There's a constant vigilance for potential threats or betrayals, and a tendency to interpret innocuous interactions and comments as covert attempts to undermine or harm them. Examples always help. Let's dive right into an example. Consider John, a middle-aged man with pronounced paranoid narcissistic tendencies. Throughout his career, he displayed subtle signs of paranoia, characterized by an excessive distrust of his colleagues. John's constant vigilance manifests in a meticulous observation of his co-workers' behaviors. He becomes fixated on perceived irregularities, such as colleagues arriving late or leaving early, leading to a heightened sense of suspiciousness. This vigilance, coupled with his inclination to overanalyze social interactions, creates a persistent cycle of vigilance, frustration, and dumping. What do I mean by dumping? John's hyper-attentiveness and mistrust prompt him to voice repeated complaints to his superiors. Despite being advised to focus on his own projects, he struggles to divert his attention from what he perceives as his colleagues, I do air quotes, getting away with a more leisurely workload. This pattern continues, ultimately frustrating his bosses because he's dumping on them, complaining to them. Despite their warnings, John's inability to curb his behavior culminates in his own termination. And this pattern continued for many years prior to me treating this fellow. I want to highlight something from this simple example that may not have come through so clearly. With this fellow, like most paranoid narcissists, there are intense feelings of a sense of betrayal and disappointment. Okay, what are the causes or origins of this kind of paranoid narcissism? To truly grasp the causes, we must turn to established theories. For now, we will focus on just one piece of one particular theory, the separation individuation process, a theory developed by Margaret Mahler. Some of you may be familiar with this. She's a renowned psychoanalyst. As we delve into the origins of paranoia, we'll turn our attention to Mahler's theory of separation and individuation. Given that I've previously discussed this theory in earlier episodes, our focus will only be on its relevance to the development of the paranoid narcissistic characteristics. As a quick reminder, the blissfulness of the symbiotic stage, which is longed for later in life, provides us with a reservoir of pleasurable and creative self-other experiences. According to the theory, when there is an attentive mother, it leads to feelings of security and safety. If the mother is not consistently present or responsive to the child's needs, it can lead to feelings of insecurity and anxiety. This lack of consistent maternal presence, this is what's been discovered in these early studies by Mahler, amongst other things, may result in the child feeling neglected or uncertain about whether their needs will be met. As a result, the child may develop a heightened sensitivity to potential threats or abandonment. This can contribute to the development of paranoid tendencies. As the child grows up with an underlying fear that others may not be trustworthy or reliable, mirroring the early experiences of inconsistent caregiving. Okay, so now you may be asking, what actually distinguishes the early experiences of children who eventually exhibit paranoid narcissistic traits? I want to emphasize, these are caregivers that are not only distracted, uninterested, and have a lack of attunement. For instance, these are not the caregivers who just use poor judgment and smother the child out of fears of their own separation anxiety. Typically, in my experience, what I have learned working with many of these individuals is this is a person who experienced excessive criticism during childhood. You may remember, this is the child who falls down, scrapes his knee, and runs to his caregiver for comfort and support, only to be blamed, yelled at, accused of being careless. "What's the matter with you?" the caregiver yells. "I don't have time for this." This is an example that I gave in an earlier episode. The message is, there's something profoundly wrong with you. "You are driving me mad. You are driving me crazy." The caregiver feels threatened or destroyed and therefore needs to attack and destroy the child. So you could see early on, the child is sort of engulfed in a world of paranoia. And this is what's put into him, this paranoid state of thinking. The child will be hated. The child will feel unworthy of love. And it is as if the child should not exist. The child is just a burden. That's the message that the child gets when they experience this kind of reaction from the caregiver. What's really critical here is how much of this, see, quantity is really important. How much of this, how often does this happen, right? Because every caregiver has, you know, a moment of regression or a moment that they're not attuned or a moment that they're annoyed or upset with the child. That's not the kind of stuff that would lead to this paranoid disposition that we're talking about today. What I'm talking about is that there is more of this excessive criticism and blaming and accusing than there is of love. So compared to other forms of narcissism, these individuals have encountered a higher frequency and intensity, by the way, but a higher frequency of early betrayals and more intense and overt attacks on their sense of self, on their sense of existence. Basically, they receive paranoid responses. To return to my earlier example with John, the paranoid man who cannot hold down a job, as a child, he told me, he was constantly subjected to criticism, harsh judgments, and unrealistic expectations. He was even called stupid and a loser when he fell short of his father's unrealistic standards. Also, a beating here and there was not uncommon, he came to describe. I've heard about many of these families where there's a lack of harmony. There's a hostile environment. There's intense conflicts among all of the family members. The family aggression sets the stage for the development of the child's own aggressiveness and sadism. Growing up in an environment where one feels constantly devalued and shamed for their very existence, it's easy to see how deep-seated feelings of shame may contribute to the development of paranoid narcissistic traits. So shame seems to be a critical ingredient in all this. So in essence, what I'm trying to suggest is the paranoia serves as a compensatory mechanism. That's what I'm really trying to get at. And now you may be asking, what am I talking about? Right? How is paranoia or suspiciousness compensatory? How does that make sense? I'm going to answer that question. But first, I want to quickly digress in terms of, because when I just said that it's compensatory, I started to think, how do we relate to these individuals? How do we better understand them? If we think about the paranoia and the suspiciousness as compensatory, what that means is that we need to appreciate the subjectively useful component of a maladaptive symptom. And you may have heard me say this before. Appreciate the subjectively useful component. In other words, what this means is these particular symptoms, right? The character traits that I described a few moments ago, all of these are maladaptive, it's true, but they serve a very important function for this individual. I am suggesting that the feelings of paranoia in a person with narcissistic traits may serve as a way to compensate for or cope with deep feelings of inadequacy, shame, or insecurity. In other words, the paranoia, in part, is a way for them to protect themselves from perceived threats or challenges to their self-esteem and sense of self-worth. Okay, so now you may be asking, how does the paranoid narcissist go about repairing deep feelings of inadequacy and shame created from this sadistic treatment that I described? How do they repair that? And how do these symptoms that we're describing, how do they repair it? See, I digress just for a moment because appreciating the subjectively useful component, and again, I know for some of you this is review, but that allows you to get closer to these individuals. And that's the ultimate goal, is we want to get closer, if we can call these symptoms, right? The paranoia as a symptom. It's not a problem. It's not something that we want to get rid of. We want to get close to it, make it our best friend. We want to live with it like the patient has lived with it. We want to understand it. We want them to understand it. Okay? So there's this deep sense of shame and humiliation because of these early childhood experiences. And that needs to be repaired. And remember, the mode of narcissistic repair for each cluster or type of narcissism is different. As compared to the craving mode of repair, the paranoid mode takes on a more hostile or aggressive form. It's expressed through argumentativeness, jealousy, suspiciousness, and accusations. They feel a sense of disappointment and betrayal by those whom they felt had the power to give them something, but it was withheld. So they have a feeling that something is being withheld from them. And there's an old saying in my field, in psychoanalysis, that there's no such thing as an absent breast, only a bad breast. What does that mean? That something just does not go missing, but that I am being mistreated. In other words, somebody is intentionally holding something from me and punishing me. I'm sure you can appreciate that interpretation, again, given that childhood experience that I described with the kid who falls down and scrapes his knee. It's hard to believe that anything that goes missing could just be missing because there's not something there. The inner world of these patients, these people, these individuals, is filled with these persecutory thoughts. So something doesn't go missing. In their mind, it's a punishment. If you listen closely enough, you will hear that one's complaints and jealousy portray a need to be the special one, to be the selected one, the one who gets special work accommodations, for instance, like John's colleagues. It's almost like John is saying, why do others get things, special care, love, sustenance, from those they feel have the power to give them what they so desperately need? In other words, you may not see this because on the surface, it simply comes out as they don't deserve it. Or what kind of workers are they? They're lazy. His colleagues are all lazy or entitled. There's nothing there. There's no message about how his colleagues are getting things that he's not getting. They get all the special privileges at work. They get to come in late and leave early, and he gets nothing. And that's the punishment. He's constantly punished because remember, the absence of something is the bad breast. Again, breast symbolically. So now I may have thoroughly confused you. So let's go back. Complaints, suspiciousness, envy, jealousy, none of this leads to any kind of narcissistic repair. So how could this be compensatory? Remember earlier I said we want to get close to these symptoms because they're compensatory. We want to appreciate them. But you're saying, how could any of this be compensatory? This only drives other people away. And eventually John got fired, right? These characteristics only get you into trouble with your romantic partners, your friends, your colleagues, and your boss. Okay, so now we have to say, how do such maneuvers serve to repair and maintain self-esteem? Because that's the ultimate goal of all the narcissists. For John, and for every narcissist, shame and humiliation are perceived as enemies of the grandiose self. Remember that blissful state that I mentioned earlier, the reunion, the magical reunion, right? The perfect self and the perfect other. The baby cries and the breast appears. So shame and humiliation are the enemy of the grandiose sense of self. This grandiose self serves as the cornerstone, as the epicenter of narcissism, so it cannot be threatened. So what does that mean? The mode of repair is to rid oneself of shame and this shameful self-concept, because this is something these individuals carry around with them because of that childhood treatment they received that I described earlier. They carry around a great deal of shame, remember, as if they shouldn't even exist. Something is so wrong with them. That's why they were treated so cruelly. So what do? The mode of repair says, look, something like this. I'm not shameful, right? I'm not shameful. That must become he's shameful. I need to get rid of it. So the mode of repair is discharge, externalization, right? It's projected. And you hear this word quite a bit as you're venturing into narcissism, is projection. So they project, there's a projection of a shameful introject. In other words, what was put into them by the caregiver. This is a shameful self-concept gets projected and put onto John's colleagues. That which has been taken in, well, with John, we could say, to some extent, forced into them since early childhood. It's not like they willingly take this shameful introject in. It's forced into them by the parent that I described earlier. What's the matter with you? This is what's forced into them, and they need to throw it out. They need to get rid of it because they don't know what to do with this. It's too unbearable to tolerate. John constantly looks for signs of shameful conduct in others, not just his colleagues at work. And that's what these paranoid narcissists do. But they do this in order to survive because they don't know how to contain. They don't know how to metabolize all these feelings that are going. They don't even know half the time that these feelings are inside of them. So there's a public repudiation of his own inner feelings. And for John, what he found in his colleagues' behavior was a perfect fit. He found an external affirmation and support of his projections. He judges his colleagues. He, much like many paranoid narcissists, saw exploitative motives in everyone. And this allows them to constantly be critical and argumentative and judgmental. The other becomes the devalued one. The other becomes the devalued sense of self, who does not complete their work, who does sloppy work, who cheats, who lies, who manipulates, who comes to work late or leaves early. So this is quite complicated. We have to think. It's so deep, like any personality disorder. This is such a part of their personality. How can this possibly be treated? How could this possibly be managed? Before we think about how to manage or relate to these individuals, how to treat them, we first need to ask, what is the goal? What are we trying to accomplish with this kind of individual? Looking at the social media content, listening to other podcasts, for instance, this is what I hear most frequently. And you could tell me, do you think the goal is to set boundaries, encourage empathy and perspective taking, teach coping strategies? See, from a psychoanalytic perspective, I'm sorry to say, my answer would be no. No, absolutely not. Those are not the goals. The goals are not to tell a grown individual how they should be living their life. You know already what I'm going to say. I foreshadowed it a little bit earlier. But the goal, the first goal is always, from a psychoanalytic perspective, from my perspective, I mean, I'm telling you what I found helpful in dealing with these patients or these individuals is the first goal, in my opinion, is to return to the theory. Let the theory guide us. And you've heard me say this before, it's not a one-to-one correspondence. No individual fits any particular theory. But the theory is the cause is the cure? What causes the patient to behave in a certain way? What causes this individual in your life to present in this way? That's the cure. We work backwards. What is the cause? What's the paranoid mode of repair? What is it repairing? It's repairing a deep sense of shame and humiliation. So the goal, with this in mind, is we must find ways to help these individuals. As always, we want to start at the most surface level, right? Because this is no easy task. It's no easy task to find a way to help somebody with something that's so deeply ingrained in their personality and something that's evacuated. It's projected, so it's not even in them. The shame and humiliation is in everybody else. It's not in them. Remember, they don't have a problem with these specific painful feelings until you listen closely. That's when you'll hear it. But in order to hear it, the first thing you need to do is get as close as possible to the subjectively useful component. So I know I'm back to that again, but I find that to be far more valuable than ever telling somebody how to live their life. Because the ultimate goal is what? That we want to help them find ways to process and manage these feelings of shame and humiliation. In my opinion, that's the ultimate goal, because if they can manage these feelings, they don't need to project them. And if they're not projecting them, the world becomes far less dangerous because not everybody's out to harm them. There's no quick fix to this one. But again, I'll share with you what's worked for me. We mentioned a few things already. Appreciate the subjectively useful component. Always start at the surface of what the individual is telling you. Always be curious. These are just the basic rules of engagement. And I've went over these in earlier episodes, but they all apply here. Always start with the manifest material. In this case, with John, it was about his need to devalue the other, to attack and devalue what the other has. The goal is to engage his curiosity, to help him begin to develop a capacity for thinking. So, as an example, one may say, did you notice that you tend to be very critical of your colleagues? I wonder what that's all about. One day, I wondered if he feels that these people should be ashamed of their behavior. See, that intervention was designed to keep the shame in his colleagues and not bring it back to him. As a general rule, if somebody's projecting something, it means they can't tolerate that feeling. We don't want to force it back into them, at least not until we can help them begin to digest and metabolize the painful feeling. It's only then that they can begin to take it back in. So, what did I say? One day I wondered if he feels these people should be ashamed of their behavior. And this led into how he sits like a judge above everyone. This is what he and I began to discuss. Above everyone, judging them. And then work in this area led him to begin to think about how he wants special treatment, like his colleagues. But with that, he said he feels embarrassed, his words. So here you see is the inner sense of shame. It begins to rear its head. And this is the way this stuff comes up. It comes up in such subtle or in little bits and pieces. But if you're attuned to it, and always having a theory in mind is helpful, because theory, like I mentioned earlier, sort of guides technique. Not really, but that's why we keep theory in the back of our mind. We hear that he felt embarrassed. So we begin to pull that to the fore, and we become very curious about that feeling state. He was embarrassed when he recognized that he wanted to feel special. When we were able to talk about his feelings, he eventually came to discuss how every day I feel like I'm not good enough. And this led to a significant shift. Now, to you, it can seem strange, I imagine, to hear me say that this fellow was not feeling good enough, his words. And that was progress, right? As if we could say, yay, somebody said they're not feeling good enough. That's progress. But the way I think about it, and what we began to see as he subsequently did not get let go of from another job again after we started making some headway into this, as we continue to work through these painful feelings of not feeling good enough, slowly we pulled away at that thread as well. And he began to develop a capacity to recognize, to name, and eventually own his own bad, painful feelings. When he can own them, and I could help him metabolize them, detoxify. Remember, this stuff is toxic, so we want to detoxify it. There was far less of a need for him to project it, to get rid of it, to put it on his colleagues. As always, there's so much more to say on this topic. I feel like I'm just beginning to warm up, but I'm always mindful of time. You know, I would like to go into more detail about how when things do shift and they start to see real benefits from the work that we're doing with them, that sometimes they regress, or oftentimes they regress, and declare whatever, that the treatment is not helping, you're not useful, there's no value to doing this, they're not changing, etc. Or as in the case with John, he suddenly became increasingly paranoid that his girlfriend, yes, he started dating and was able to get into a relationship, that his girlfriend was cheating on him. We have to leave it there for now. If you have any questions or want to dive deeper to any of the topics you heard today, feel free to shoot me an email. I would be delighted to hear from you. Also, this kind of stuff, in my opinion, is very complicated. If there's anything that I said that was confusing, or if I inadvertently confused you with any of the theory or the techniques or anything that I mentioned today, please feel free to reach out. I would love to hear from you. Until next time, engage your mind. Bye for now. Disclaimer alert. The Narcissism Dakota podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The content presented in this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any psychological condition related to narcissism. The content on this podcast should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For specific advice pertaining to narcissism or any other psychological condition, you could reach me directly. I am an experienced mental health practitioner who is always taking on new patients. If you would just like a consultation, I can do that too.